This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
One of my dad's favorite quotes is saying, you know, when he passes away, he's not really sure about heaven. Heaven actually could be a step down for him because for him, heaven was playing for the Boston Celtics.
That's Karen Russell talking about her father, Celtics legend Bill Russell, in a classic ESPN piece. Russell passed away yesterday at the age of 88. Bill Russell's time in Boston and the impact he made on the team, the city, the sport, the country are actually complicated. Joining us now to help reflect on the Celtics legend's life and legacy, two of the best voices we could imagine for the moment. Howard Bryant is a senior writer for ESPN and sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Howard, welcome back. Well, thank you. And Dan Shaughnessy, Boston Globe sports reporter and author of author of Wish It Lasted Forever, Life with the Larry Bird Celtics. Dan, welcome back to you as well.
Nice to be back. Thank you.
Appreciate you joining us. Listen, I just want to start by giving you both the floor to tell us what's been on your mind over the last 24 hours. And I'm hoping the two of you will talk to each other as well. Howard, why don't you get us rolling?
Well, I was in New York yesterday on the Metro North coming home when I saw the news alert, and it just, I mean, I think, what do you say, when someone is 88 years old, we're all day-to-day at that stage, but it's still just a tremendous, tremendous blow, because now all the emotions are coming back, and you're thinking, I think when we were offline, Dan and I were talking about just the, you protect your own time. You protect your time. And, you know, growing up in Boston as a kid, I mean, the specter of the Celtics were everywhere. And I just immediately started thinking about that period, that Bob Cousy is the last remaining Celtic from the 57 team. And we lost Sam Jones last year. We lost Casey Jones in 2020. We lost Tommy Heinsohn. And all of a sudden, you're thinking about that period, and it was so central to everything. And of course, Russell was the center of all of it. And he was the one that was always the start of every conversation, whether you're talking about the Celtic dynasty, or whether you're talking about all the complications of race in Boston, or you're talking about the number of championships. And just when you know, Bob Ryan, you know, Dan's colleague, has always talked about how Bill Russell never lost a winner-take-all game. Just all of it. It all just came rolling back for me, and it was just very sad, but also made you think very much about how special that man really was.
How about you, Dan Shaughnessy?
Well, again, I'm a little bit older than Howard, thankfully. He's a youngster by my standards, and I'll tell you, I mean, you know, but growing up in Massachusetts, when I did in the late 50s, early 60s, we had the Celtics. The other teams weren't very good, and they were such a model team, and so great for local teachers and coaches and educators, because we had in our midst this group of men. They were Hall of Fame athletes. They were a true team. They taught you how to win, subjugating your ego, how to put team above self. And how, like, Bill Russell was the embodiment of this, because he didn't need the ball. He didn't need the rock, didn't care about touches. Really, his contract, it wasn't ego, wasn't a scoring champion. He was a winner. He would do what it took to win. Watch him in the shot blocking when they show his shot blocks. He's never swatting the ball into the stands to impress the cheerleaders. He's tipping it to a teammate to get the fast break going. And this was the way he played. This is the way he led. Red Auerbach at the top. But until they got Russell, they couldn't get over the hump. Once they got Russell, 11 championships in 13 years. And we can and will go, you know, first black head coach in American sports. You know, his career as a social justice warrior, on and on. Took no quarter, suffered no fools. Lived his own life on his own terms. But the greatest winner in American sports history, at the top of Boston's Mount Rushmore, you can go from there. My first instinct was to call my brother. My brother was a 6'1 white pivot man at Groton High School. His idol was Bill Russell. You had to. Your idol was Bill Russell if you grew up and we grew up. And he was just always a part of our culture. And it's weird for me to be living in a world that Bill Russell's no longer living in.
So what I want to do, Howard Bryant, is bring to people who may not know Russell's legacy and history a little bit more of that. I'm going to play a little sound here from, you know, former coach, legend Red Auerbach, about Russell's tenacious defense.
He made the shot blocking an art. He was so outstanding and proved that quickness and finesse and brains was a match for brawn.
And, you know, Russell himself has famously said, I brought the vertical game to basketball, which was a horizontal game. Talk a little bit about his influence on the game with his physicality, his athleticism, his height, and his approach as a center.
He changed the modern game. I mean, what you're watching right now, it goes back. And as much as people like to talk about, oh, well, today's players would just demolish those players back then, don't be so sure. Don't be so sure. And it's not really true. And you think about the way the game was played. There are players who come in and they fundamentally shift what the sport is. We see it today with Steph Curry. We saw it in the early days with Dr. J and all that. And you go all the way back to Russell, and you look and you see how the center position was a on-the-floor position. You were applauding George Mikan guy. You were a big, burly guy. You were wearing number 99. And what Russell did was Russell came in and he changed that position. And as Dan was saying, not even offensively. I mean, he could score if he needed to, but what he really did was, I just love the old anecdote that the Celtics used to employ the "Hey Bill" defense, where whenever one guy got beat, they would yell "Hey Bill," and Bill would just cross the lane and cover, and you know, and just he could guard 2 men at once, and he was the modern guy that really did change how defenses were played, how the game was played, and then on top of that, the transitions game, the Celtics were known, they invented essentially the fast break, and that all comes from defense. It doesn't come from offense. And as much as we talk about Wilt Chamberlain changing the sport in terms of goaltending, in terms of 3 second violation, all of those things, when he came along in 1959, 1960, Bill Russell, as Dan was saying earlier, changed the entire arc of the sport, because the Celtics were a very good team. They had never even gotten to the NBA Finals before Russell.
So let's talk about that for a minute, Dan Shaughnessy. Let's just talk about the record. So Russell plays in college in California, plays in the Olympics. In fact, the Boston Celtics wait for him a couple of months to finish his Olympic responsibilities before he comes to the Celtics. And then, just for listeners who don't know, give the litany of rings that are more than fingers over the next several years.
Well, Howard has cited a lot of this, and again, he never lost a decisive seventh game. And you go back to his 56 straight wins at the University of San Francisco, 2 NCAA championships. So every tournament, they win every game. They go to Melbourne, they win every game, come back with a gold medal. As you say, the Celtics waited for him. And as Howard said, they had been very good, a good team, not a great team, not yet. They had Bob Cousy, they had Bill Sharman, they had guys, they had Hall of Famers. They get Russell, and they win the NBA championship in his rookie season. And he's epic in the final against the St. Louis Hawks. And then next year, they're going to win again, and Russell hurts his toe or his ankle or something and had to step aside. They lose to St. Louis. Well, then they won 8 in a row, 8 consecutive championships, Bill Russell there. Red's going to retire from the bench. He says, well, who am I going to get to coach Russell? I know, Bill Russell makes him player coach for the last 2 seasons of his career. And Russell at that point is playing the game and coaching the team. First black head coach in North American sports. And in the final year of his career, they finish in 4th place. They're not that good. They end up in the finals against a Laker team with Wilt Chamberlain, Jerry West, Elgin Baylor. They're on the road. They win game 7 on the road, and Bill Russell walks away. You can't do better than that. 11 championships in 13 years, every 7th game, every decisive game, he wins the game, and he walks away at the top of his game.
Yeah, and Dan, you know what I love about that, too, is the fact that when people try to compare eras, which you should never, ever do, but in trying to compare the eras, they say, well, there were only 8 teams in the league back then, and you didn't have to go through 18 rounds of playoffs and whatever. But if you go back and look at those finals, go look at those playoff series, every one of them were close. They all, I mean, so many of them, okay, they sweep the Lakers in 59, but for the most part, every one of those come down to a Game 7, either Eastern Conference against Philly, against Wilt, or you've got the Lakers. They beat the Lakers every time.
So I want to talk
to your point, to Howard's point, if I can amplify that.
Yeah.
They use that as a talking point when they say 8 or 9 teams in a league. That makes it harder because the concentration of talent is so
exactly.
much greater. When you have 9 teams and now you have 30 teams, there's just more bad teams now. But back then, every team had good players because there were so few teams.
I want to talk about the mental side for just a minute, and then we'll move on to who he was off the court, too. Here's a little sound of Russell himself, Bill Russell, and let me just reset for everybody. We are talking about the legendary Bill Russell, who passed away yesterday at 88. I have Howard Bryant here from ESPN and Dan Shaughnessy from the Boston Globe. Here's Russell talking about his own approach to playing with ESPN.
We shut a guy down, or we block a guy's shot and say, yes, we did that to you. If you come back, we'll do it again. If you come back again, we'll do it another time. So you'll have to try something else to do. That won't work.
So, Dan Shaughnessy, there was an element of making you pay, making you rethink your game, making you, you know, burrowing into your brain. And that's not something I had known as much about Russell until the conversation remembering him over the last day or so.
I'll tell you one that goes to that. One of the few times he was in a good mood around me and around us, I mean, he was storytelling, which was rare. He was in a good place. He came to the Globe telling stories. We could get him to talk about anything at this time. I think he was helping his daughter's mentoring program at Harvard. And he said his favorite story was his regular season game against the Lakers. And the Celtics are down by 2 points, 10 seconds to go. The Lakers have the ball. Well, the play there is you're going to have to foul them or they're going to dribble out the clock, whatever. But Bill Russell during the timeout says, well, Archie Clark's in the game. I know he's a scorer. If I create a path to the basket, he's going to go for it. He's going to go for two more points that they don't even need. They inbound the ball. He creates a path. Archie Clark goes to the hoop. Russell comes up, chase down block. They get the ball back. They score, put it in overtime. They win the game because he exploited the mentality of his opposition. He could think how they were going to think and anticipate what they were going to do. And that stuff worked for him.
Yeah. And on top of that, I think that people, obviously Bill Russell was retired before, you know, I never got the chance to see him play. I was a year old when he retired. But when we think about superstar players, we always think about them in terms of scores because that's what superstars do. But not Russell. Russell in the championship game in 69 when they beat the Lakers, he scored 6 points. He had 21 rebounds. He had 6 points. And so what he did was constantly take away what the other team was doing. He made you think about him more than he thought about his own offense. And that's really, really rare. And it's especially rare today when all we do is focus on offense. He's one of the handful of players that you could look at and say was one of the greatest players of all time and, as Dan was saying, didn't need the ball. And yet, when it was time to do something, go back to 62, 30 points, 40 rebounds. If he needed to put the ball in the basket, he could.
So I'm just going to quote him from a story that Bob Ryan wrote for the Boston Globe in 1999, where Russell said, quote, people talk about my scoring. I could have scored more. Say I averaged 16 points a game in an average year. If I wanted to go to 19 or 21 a game, I'd have to take 4 or 5 more shots. That would have disrupted the offensive continuity of our team. My idea was always for the energy to flow from me to them, end quote. Kind of underscoring your point there, Howard. And I'll stay with you for a minute. Because in our remaining time, I don't want to miss who else Russell was and the price that he paid in his legend for being a black activist, for being a black man first, breaking ground in the NBA, for not being quiet about his experience in Boston. Reflect on that a little bit.
Well, it's not just Boston. And I think that to remember Russell is to understand that the most important thing about Bill Russell was that he was a black man born in 1934 in Monroe, Louisiana. And I say that because there are a lot of black people who were born in 1934. But the thing about Russell was that he carried it with him. He did not play the game where he was going to allow his celebrity or his fame to make everybody else feel better about his fame. He was like, no. I am who I am because you are who you are. He lives in Louisiana. They moved to Oakland because of the violence in Louisiana. He lives in West Oakland because black people aren't allowed to live anywhere else. He's playing in Boston because St. Louis is so racist, they're not going to draft perhaps the greatest player of all time, and they end up drafting him and then trading him to the Celtics. So every step in his journey has some sort of racial element to it. I mean, think of how different the history of the NBA would be if St. Louis kept Bill Russell.
Mm. So Dan Shaughnessy, I want to pick up on that. Boston Globe columnist Renee Graham tweeted yesterday that fans in a city where Bill Russell played his entire unparalleled career, routinely called Tom Brady the GOAT, is such a tell about Boston. We know that Russell loved the Celtics, but that he had a hard relationship with Boston. For example, in the town Reading where he lived, he was both honored and his home was vandalized and people defecated in his beds. And it was a complicated history. Have we consistently shortchanged him in his place in the Boston pantheon?
Oh, I think that's a fact. I mean, the fact that there's arguments about the greatest athlete of all time. We have the Mount Rushmore. Every city's got him. We happen to have Tom Brady in football, Bobby Orr in hockey, Ted Williams in baseball, and, of course, Bill Russell in basketball. Some people would even put Bird in there. Like, no, Larry Bird was great, but he's not Bill Russell. He didn't win 11 championships. So you've got that. And when you pile in all the championships, the leadership, the coaching, it's just he pretty much dusts off everybody. Not the greatest individual player. And the GOAT thing with Brady, that's quarterbacks. That's Michael Jordan is supposed to be the GOAT in basketball. So I don't conflate those things. I don't, Boston was not the perfect place for Bill Russell to start his NBA career. Everybody knows that, you know. They weren't ready for this. And as Howard pointed out, he did not suffer fools. He was not going to just, you know, make people feel better so they would feel better. So he let them know, this man, read his books, read his writing, read The Diary of an Opinionated Man, Second Wind with Taylor Branch. Read that book and he'll tell you. He said Boston was a flea bag of racism. And he was right about what he was saying at the time. He grew into it a little more. There was a little more forgiveness later on, but he wasn't going to just say, hey, everything was great, because it wasn't.
And Howard, I wonder now, he was socially active. He marched with Martin Luther King Jr. He stood up for Muhammad Ali when Ali refused to fight in the Vietnam War. You think to somebody like Patriots safety Devin McCourty today, who uses his platform as an athlete and as a black athlete to talk about criminal justice reform. Do we not have a Devin McCourty today if we didn't have a Bill Russell then?
No, that's a lineage, and you have to have that lineage. It's the reason why these black athletes always have a responsibility that other athletes don't have. That why does this always land on their shoulders? Because they are always so visible. I always say it, that the black athlete in the United States is the most visible, most successful, and most influential black employee this country has ever produced. And part of the reason is because of the responsibility that these players have placed upon the future generations, that what Jackie Robinson did spurs on Bill Russell, which spurs on Muhammad Ali, and you feel like you have a responsibility to live up to that. And if you don't live up to that, people will remind you that you didn't. Just go ask Michael Jordan. And so the Russell impact is just so enormous. You can, you know, we could talk about this for an hour.
Let's bring it back to the game as we go out here, because he also really called out players to be as passionate for the win as he was. And I want to go out on a little bit of sound. This is a moment between Russell and Kevin Garnett, another player known for leaving it all on the court. This is from 2008 when the two were in conversation about what it means to play for the Celtics.
I'll share one of mine with you.
I'll tell you,
this is a genuine friendship thing I'm talking about. But if you play the way you play, and you dedicate yourself to doing it, they will come. It's like they feel the dreams. If you build it, they will come. You may have to put your arms around a couple guys and take them with you. But you can't drag them. You got to put your arms around and take them with you. Okay? And, you have no idea how proud I am of you. I couldn't be any more proud of you than I am of my own kids. And I see you at number 5. That's close to 6.
The voice of Bill Russell himself, who died yesterday at 88. Any final thoughts from either of you, Dan Shaughnessy, Howard Bryant?
Well, that was beautiful to hear. And, you know, Garnett had the fire, so Bill Russell could see the fire in him. And imagine being young Kevin Garnett and hearing those words come from Bill Russell. That would motivate you to go out and do something.
Yeah, 100%. I remember when Garnett came to the Celtics in the 07-08 season, just watching him. I said, I've never seen Bill Russell play, but that's really probably what it must have been like, watching somebody just dominate, you know, the defensive board and letting everybody know that that your presence is here defensively. And I just love that because he embraced it so much. I mean, Garnett really did take on that mantle. For someone who wasn't here that long, he's a true Celtic in that in the Russell mode.
All right. Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN. Dan Shaughnessy, Boston Globe sports reporter and author of Wish It Lasted Forever, Life with the Larry Bird Celtics, helping us remember Bill Russell today. The true Celtics great. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Just after 5 a.m., that is when Politico's Lisa Kuczynski blearily tweeted that the state legislature had reached a compromise on sports betting in Massachusetts. The deal looked iffy last week as lawmakers remained divided over college games, but not anymore. Here with more on this compromise is a sleepless himself. WBUR senior statehouse reporter Steve Brown joins us for this week's From the Newsroom. Hey there, Steve.
Hey, Tiziana.
Promise we'll let you sleep soon, but in the meantime,
thank you.
we joke, right? That the legislature likes to wait until the last minute, but okay, talk about last minute. Have you ever seen 11th hour deal making like this?
Never quite like this. I've covered a lot of final days of the session, and things tend to pop. Usually, there's like four or five things still in the balance going into that final day. And they tend to pop in the afternoon, maybe early evening. You might get one that comes in at 11 o'clock. And then they go through the motions, get it done. And then by quarter past 12, 12:30, they've shut off the lights and gone home. This one, they didn't shut off the lights until 10:15 this morning.
And this was the sticky wicket here, right, was about college sports betting. Last week, Senate President Karen Spilka made a bit of a buzz here on Radio Boston when she said she wanted Speaker Mariano to stop treating college betting as a deal breaker. He snapped back on Friday, well, if she wants me to be flexible, she needs to be flexible. Looks like everyone got flexible, so where did we come out?
We came out with a true compromise in the middle. You know, as you said, the House wanted, you know, you got to have college sports, and the Senate was saying no. You know the colleges here in Massachusetts don't want it. And at one point, you know, I almost piped up and said, "Hey, well, why don't you just, you know, carve out Massachusetts?" Maybe I should have spoken up, and I could have got a good night's sleep last night.
You do kind of wonder, but, Steve. Well, just stay with that for a second. Once I heard what they'd done, they carve out Massachusetts, you're like, how did that take till 5 a.m. after? I mean, why was that not on the table earlier?
I don't know. They just kind of hold out. And then, you know, once the clock strikes midnight and then you're in, it's like, okay, we're in overtime here. We got to do something. We can't come away completely empty handed. Karen Spilka wanted a mental health bill. Ron Mariano wanted the sports betting bill. It seems like both of those kind of went hand in hand. And in the middle of the night, just before 5 o'clock, they said, "Hey, we've got an agreement."
Anything else huge that you want to feature from that agreement?
Yeah, well, you know, they did come up with that compromise. You can't bet on local college sports. No Massachusetts colleges. So I can't put a sawbuck down on the Emerson College Lions as much as I'd like to. There are exceptions, though, if the local teams go into a national tournament, say a bowl game or the Final Four or the Frozen Four. If a local team goes into that, then you can wager on those national games, but nothing within Massachusetts.
And something about credit cards as well, Steve. Is that right?
Yeah, that was a Senate provision. The Senate really wanted some guardrails on this, so they've banned the use of credit cards. You gotta put down hard-earned cash to put your wager down. They've got some programs in there to fight problem gambling. There's a few other things in there that you know, we'll have the Gaming Commission will promulgate the rules. That kind of helps this time around. If you remember back in 2011 when they legalized casino gaming, there was no Gaming Commission. They had to start from scratch. So now you have a Gaming Commission that's been really following this and getting ready for the day when the legislature says, okay, we can have sports betting in Massachusetts. The Gaming Commission is set to do that. There's a lot of technical language in the bill. My eyes are bleary enough, so I haven't read through everything. It speculates or specifies who can hold a license, who can't, and all sorts of nuances that kind of in the weeds.
All right. And before we let you go for a break here, Steve, in a word, do you think Governor Baker will sign this?
I do. I do think he will sign it. He's expressed support for the concept. I don't see why he wouldn't.
All right. We will bring you back in just a little bit. WBUR Senior State House reporter Steve Brown. Hang tight. But I'm going to turn now to Andrew Zimbalist, who is a professor emeritus of economics at Smith College and has been following the legalization of sports betting nationwide, to give us some context here. Professor Zimbalist, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So I know you listened to Steve's reporting just there. Any reactions to the compromise that came out, you know, just post 5 a.m. this morning?
Well, only to say that other states have also carved out local colleges. And it was an obvious compromise that could have been made earlier and much quicker. So it is somewhat surprising. And the notion that they say, okay, you can bet on local teams as long as they're in a national tournament, that too has been talked about and legislated elsewhere. So, look, I mean, you know, fundamentally, in my view, betting on college sports is going to be perilous, whether or not you're carving out local colleges. College athletes, although it's beginning to change, and we don't know how much it's going to change, but college athletes have not been paid a salary. They get, if they're lucky, they get tuition, room and board and a full scholarship, but they're not paid a salary. And that puts them in a very vulnerable position relative to any gambling rings that might approach them and say, could you blow a game? Or if you're not blowing the game, could you help us with our point spread by doing X, Y, and Z? In professional sports in the United States, where, of course, since 2018, sports betting has been legalized or not legalized, but not prohibited. In professional sports where the athletes are averaging $2, $3, $4, $5 million or NBA, it's $6.5 million salary a year. They're not nearly as susceptible to being influenced by gamblers.
So let's follow.
Sports, they are.
So let's follow up on that. I understand 30 states plus Washington D.C. have legalized some form of sports betting since 2018. You've said some have carved out local colleges, some haven't. Have we seen evidence of you know activity that has pulled college athletes into throwing games in other states where college betting is legal and local college betting is legal?
No, we haven't. At least not that's become extant, not that's become public. But a lot of states, there are 30 states, a lot of them were passing legislation in 2020, 2021. College sports, of course, have been held back a little bit by the pandemic. And it remains to be seen exactly how far that proceeds.
So early days on that. Let me ask you, the price to get into this business. The legislature plans to charge $5 million for each five-year license. Mobile operators would also have to pay $1 million annually in addition to that licensing fee so that there will be both in-person and mobile app betting. State could issue up to 11 licenses. It's not a lot of licenses. It's a lot of money. How does that compare to other states? And what could it mean for smaller business operations?
Well, I'm not sure I have the answer to all of those questions. The estimates I've seen is that approximately $60 million in revenue will be generated annually by sports betting in Massachusetts. For the Massachusetts government. The problem is that there's going to be a race to the bottom. I mean, the main motivation, I think, here behind the legislature was to not forgo all of the wonderful revenue that you can earn by allowing sports betting. But what's going to happen over time is that some states are going to have more lax rules than others. And in order to compete with those states and to continue getting gambling revenue, the regulations will be relaxed over time. And so it's just going to become much more of an open jungle kind of competition than we have initially. The other thing that might happen, of course, is we could get national legislation that would override at least aspects of the state legislation.
So we are speaking with Andrew Zimbalist, who is a professor emeritus of economics at Smith College and follows the legalization of sports betting nationwide. You're a sports fan. How do you feel as a fan about legalizing sports betting in Massachusetts?
Well, I'm not one of the fans who's going to bet. I understand from different surveys that about 50 to 60% of male college athletes do engage in sports betting. And there'll be a lot of fans out there who do bet. And my concern generally is that sports in the United States has been something that builds community. It's been something that galvanizes people. It gives them something to relate to talk to each other about, to get excited about. There's been a particular way that sports has fit into our culture. With sports betting, my concern is that larger and larger shares of fandom will be motivated by the possibility of earning money in sports bets. That's going to change our relationship to sports, college sports and professional sports in this country. And it's going to undermine the traditional role, I think, that sports has played. So I'm concerned on the one hand that there'll be gambling that corrupts the games, but I'm also concerned that gambling more generally will corrupt the cultural role of sports in the United States.
All right, that is Andrew Zimbalist, a professor emeritus of economics at Smith College, who has been following the legalization of sports betting nationwide, giving us some perspective on the, I wouldn't even say overnight, early morning compromise that the Massachusetts state legislature achieved on sports betting. Thank you for joining us, Professor Zimbalist.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So I do want to turn back now to WBUR senior statehouse reporter Steve Brown, mostly because I just don't want you to get any sleep, Steve. Thank you for staying with us. You can do it. You can do it. So first, any reactions to what you just heard from Professor Zimbalist?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting that, you know, the state didn't have to reinvent the wheel here. Other states have come up with the same compromise. And why this wasn't on the radar last week or 2 weeks ago, you know, that has me scratching my head. But, you know, it is what it is. And we have a sports gambling bill now on the governor's desk. And it will be a reality soon.
So just briefly, what else landed on the governor's desk in the wee hours? Two or three other areas where it came down to the wire and they got something passed?
Yeah, some big things. The mental health bill, you know, where sports gambling was Ron Mariano's priority, Karen Spilka's priority was this mental health care bill. This bill put some teeth into the enforcement at the Division of Insurance. Health insurance plans are supposed to cover mental health services, just like you would get a physical checkup, which is covered by your insurance. The mental health should be as well, but there hasn't been a lot of enforcement of that. It also requires that you get an annual mental health checkup. That those are made available to you. They also, some other bills that they got through, the climate bill, the governor had sent that back to the legislature over the weekend. They tweaked it a bit, but not much. They're banking on him not tanking the whole thing because it's not exactly the way he wants it.
And so just to underscore again for listeners, when you say betting on him to not tank the whole thing, that's because he now has 10 days to veto, amend, et cetera, or sign?
He can't amend it. He can veto it, he can sign it, or he can let it become law without his signature. And the legislators, I think we're calling his bluff on this particular issue. He had some concerns. They addressed a couple, but kept the bill pretty much the way they originally had it. And they don't think that he will tank the whole thing just because it isn't exactly the way he wants it.
And Steve, in our last 60 seconds or so, the economic development bill did not survive, for lack of a better phrase, these last-minute negotiations. Talk about that.
Yeah, that was surprising because they usually come up with an economic development bill every session. It's loaded with, it was like $4 billion, I'm sorry. That's billion with a B. Loaded up with things for, you know, housing and unemployment insurance, all these different things that benefit all the legislators' districts. They pack it full of stuff so that they can go back home and say, hey, look what I brought home. Well, this time they're not bringing it home. It didn't get through.
Because there was a tax relief package that was part of it, and then Governor Baker surprised everyone saying there might be some other tax rebate triggered by a law, right?
That's right. That came out of nowhere last week, last Thursday, when the governor was signing the budget. And that just basically put everything into a tailspin. Legislature thinking that that if we have to give $3 billion back to taxpayers, that basically upsets the whole apple cart. Everything that we've put together for the state's finances and everything is now thrown out the window. So they've got to take a step back, figure out what they're going to do. They may try to revisit it between now and the first week of January. We'll just have to wait and see.
WBUR Senior State House Reporter Steve Brown, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tiziana.
President Joe Biden has COVID rebound, yet another signal of how pernicious the Omicron variants are proving to be. Both Pfizer and Moderna are rushing to make Omicron-specific boosters, but school starts as early as this month, and then there is the continued spread of MPV or the monkeypox virus. It is time to ask the doctors. Joining us now, Dr. Mark Seidner, a clinical epidemiologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and Dr. Cassandra Pierre, infectious disease physician and medical director of public health programs at the Boston Medical Center. Dr. Seidner, welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be here, as always.
And Dr. Pierre, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Seidner, let's talk number trends with COVID right now. New cases are stable. Hospitalizations and COVID in our wastewater have decreased by 15% and 21% respectively in the week leading up to this past Friday. We do continue to hear a drumbeat of concern about cases. So, where are we?
You know, we are where we've been, I think, for the last two or three months. Things have been pretty consistent since the big Omicron surge. And that means that cases are still here, hospitalizations are still here, and deaths are still here, albeit not as high as they were a few months ago. I think what's concerning to us in the public health realm is that they really haven't disappeared. We haven't seen the summer lull that we saw last year and we were hoping to see this year. And we know that this new variant, BA5, is here. It's quite contagious, and it is still continuing to cause disease. So we're bracing for the fall. We wish numbers were lower. They're not as bad as they were, but it's definitely still around. And I think protection is still important.
So, Dr. Cassandra Pierre, and I'm going to note, we have a bit of a delay on your line. So I'll account for that, but I just want listeners to know that. We reached out to our texting group to ask them if they had questions for Ask the Doctors today. I'm going to pepper some of those in. Right away, we heard from Caitlin in Stoneham, who has a question about repeated COVID infections, which Omicron is raising. So Caitlin asks, quote, if I've already had COVID twice, August 2021 and May 2022, does that make me more susceptible to get it again or less? I have been fully vaccinated and boosted, but never felt bad after any of my shots. Does that mean they didn't work since I then got COVID twice? Both cases were mild. End quote. Let's focus especially on that first part, the way over Omicron has an ability to overcome previous infection and any immunity from that. Where are we?
Yeah, so I would say Caitlin is right on it. There is a risk. There's always been a risk of reinfection, but with these Omicron subvariants, especially BA.5, we are seeing really an unprecedented ability to get around both vaccine and infection-derived immunity. And so it is unfortunately well-placed to cause reinfections, even among people who were sick in the spring. So traditionally, we tell people, if you've been infected, you know, within 90 days, you're probably unlikely to be reinfected. Unfortunately, we've seen a number of reinfections within 90 days. It doesn't mean that our vaccines are not working. They absolutely are, but they are primarily really working hard to prevent severe disease, hospitalization, and death. With the immunity, with the evasion, immune evasion we've seen with these new subvariants, they unfortunately are very well poised to cause reinfection, although our vaccines are still working for us.
So, Dr. Pierre, we're having a little more trouble with your line. I think we're going to try to get you on a more solid line. In the meantime, I'm going to turn back to you, Dr. Mark Seidner. One of the questions that has come up, for those who qualify for the age 50 plus additional booster, but may not have gotten it yet, and I'm thinking of the public health data that the city of Boston released last week that showed that while more than 70% of Boston residents were fully vaccinated, less than 50% had received a booster that they had an option to receive. Does, in the short term, that booster provide any additional protection from contracting these very infectious variants? Or are we at a stage now where boosters right now really are about severe illness and death?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think those are two separate questions. I think what we know now is that the vaccines do a less good job of protecting against infection as they did with the older variants. where they were 90% effective. Now we see the effectiveness of these booster doses is more in the 30 to 50% range. But I think very importantly, what do we do? Why do we use vaccines and what are they for? They're to stop us from getting hospitalized, to stop us from getting extremely ill and dying. And what we've seen is that with that second booster, compared to people who have been vaccinated, there's about a 30% decreased risk of death. But even compared to people over 50 who've only gotten one booster, those who've gotten two still have about a 3 to 4 times less chance of getting severely ill or dying with that extra shot. We've seen this in May, we've seen this in June. These numbers are consistent. The vaccines are still working for what we want them to do. And I do suggest that people over 50 or those with risk factors who are eligible for a second shot, it's not too late to get it, and it can still have a major impact on your health.
All right. Do we have you back, Dr. Cassandra Pierre?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we are doing Ask the Doctors with Dr. Cassandra Pierre of Boston Medical Center and Dr. Mark Seidner of Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Pierre, I'm going to bring you another question from our subtext group. And for listeners, if you'd like to join our texting group to ask questions of Ask the Doctors and a number of other segments we do on Radio Boston, text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's Boston to 617-766-0382. And if I went too fast, you can find that information on the About section of our website at radioboston.org. So, Dr. Pierre, Jake in Melrose asks about this, and I think it follows on what we just heard from Dr. Seidner. At first, when the mask mandate was lifted on public transit, I kept wearing a mask anyway just to be safe. I haven't had symptomatic COVID and would like to keep avoiding it. However, that week, I did come down with a fever of something, probably because my immune system was particularly weak after 2 years of quarantine. Is it safer if I am vaccinated and generally healthy to wear a mask in public spaces, or should I be strengthening my immune system by allowing exposure to colds, flus, possibly even COVID, if there's no reason to expect long-term effects, end quote?
So this is an interesting question. It seems to be about a trade-off of wearing a mask to protect yourself against COVID or letting it off and letting the world in. And it's true that there are a lot of other respiratory viruses that are circulating, many are circulating in our nurseries and in day-to-day life. That said, I would potentially dispute the definition of strengthening the immune system by allowing yourself to get these viral infections. I think we've had enough of putting our lives on hold. And I certainly, as the mother of 2 school-age children who's gotten repeated viral infections, don't necessarily feel like my immune system has been strengthened by having a succession of non-COVID-related upper respiratory tract infections. So I would say that understanding that everyone has a different risk tolerance at this point, both to COVID and other respiratory tract infections, looking at who you have in your sphere, who may be at higher risk for severe effects should you get COVID, should you transmit it to them, and understanding what your priorities are in your day-to-day life, I have chosen myself to continue to wear a mask in indoor spaces on public transportation because I prefer not to get sick, not because I'm concerned that I'm going to become severely ill or be hospitalized. My vaccines have been working really well for me, but I'd prefer not to get it and not to spread it to those in my life who are older or who are immunocompromised. I don't really think there is necessarily a trade-off in terms of wearing the mask and having a weakened immunity. And I think that, you know, in terms of exposures to viruses, those in your immediate sphere can certainly do the work of bringing those viruses to you, should that be something that you're interested in doing. But I don't think the mask is necessarily going to preclude you and or weaken your immune system in any way.
So, Dr. Cassandra Pierre there, I'll turn now to Dr. Mark Seidner. I have a vaccine question for you. So the Biden administration has reached a deal with Moderna to buy 66 million doses of the next generation vaccines that target Omicron specifically. There's an order of 105 million of a similar vaccine pending from Pfizer in June. Those new targeted boosters are not yet out and authorized. For people who are trying to figure out, if I get a booster now, do I then not get the Omicron one, or should I wait for the Omicron one? And when will the Omicron one come, especially after conversations at the federal level last week that perhaps not authorizing or issuing another booster for people under 50 makes sense in order to wait for the Omicron specific. So kind of a limbo there, Dr. Seidner. What's your reaction?
Yeah, I think that for those who currently qualify for that fourth dose, as we're calling it, the second booster. These are people of older ages. These are people with immune suppressing conditions. I do think that the booster dose now is warranted, and I do recommend it. Similar to what we just discussed, we are still seeing increased risks of death in older people and those who are immunosuppressed who don't get that additional dose. And I think there's no reason to wait. For those who don't yet qualify, I think you can hear soon in the next 2 or 3 months, we are expecting, as you mentioned, a new round of boosters, which I think are going to probably become seasonal vaccines, similar to influenza. Those will be targeted to the current circulating viruses, and it's expected that this next round of vaccines, as you mentioned, will be targeted probably to something like BA5. And so I think for those who don't qualify for the second booster, waiting for those to come out makes the most sense. For those who do, I do think there's benefit to getting it now, even if you haven't gotten it yet.
So Dr. Cassandra Pierre, I'm going to shift for just a minute to MPV or the monkeypox virus. Massachusetts saw 36 additional cases last week, bringing the state's total to 115 cases as of July 28. We are now at more than 5,000 cases nationwide as of July 29th. On a scale of 1 to 5, sort of the Richter scale, where does this spread sit for you? And how concerned should we be about our state's preparedness to address it?
So as an individual, I would say that, you know, I'm certainly not afraid or concerned. I've had, unfortunately, 2+ years of that. However, I do want to be sure that as individuals we are vigilant. We know that monkeypox is not a sexually transmitted infection. It's a disease from contact, and most of us are in contact with other people. So there are things that we know that we should be aware of: rashes on the skin of our loved ones, partners, friends that we come into contact with, making sure that we keep up good hand hygiene and understanding.
And I'm sorry, Dr. Pierre, let me interrupt for just a moment. When you say contact, you predominantly mean physical contact, correct?
I apologize. Yeah, it's physical contact, but also it can be contact with linens, bed sheets, clothing that individuals who may have been sick have come into contact with. So yes, so through touch and through also sharing bedding and other resources and surfaces. That is how this predominantly is transmitted. And again, that's not just through one particular group of individuals. As individuals, we know that we should be keeping vigilant and understanding that, like every virus, there is no predilection for one group of people. We do know that as a state, we have been hobbled by the restricted numbers of tests and vaccines that have been made available to us. And so while our state and our local public health agencies are really trying to work as quickly as they can, we have unfortunately been at a disadvantage because we don't know what we don't test. And we've been prioritizing our testing and our vaccines among men who have sex with men. Understandably, this is the highest risk group that we have at this point. But understanding, again, that this is not a sexually transmitted infection, we've missed opportunities to both test individuals who we've been concerned about, who have rashes and otherwise meet the criteria for concern for monkeypox, and also vaccinating people who may become at high risk. And because of that, we're just, you know, I worry, there is some concern there. I would say probably on a scale of 1 to 5, I guess I would say a 3, that, you know, monkeypox might be slowly filtering through our population. Again, I don't want to unduly raise a cause for concern as individuals. We certainly can and should remain vigilant. We shouldn't be frightened. But there's so much more that we need to do to protect our population and to test and make sure that we know and provide appropriate surveillance for the cases of monkeypox that are now circulating in our state and our country.
Thank you. And we will continue to follow that and talk about that here on Radio Boston. That was Dr. Cassandra Pierre, infectious disease physician and medical director of public health programs at Boston Medical Center, as well as Dr. Mark Seidner, clinical epidemiologist at Massachusetts General Hospital and associate professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School. Thank you, both of you, for joining us today on Ask the Doctors.
Thanks, Tiziana.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thank you for starting your week with us. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.